Good afternoon. Welcome to the New Art Gallery in Warsaw. Thank you for joining us today for the In Conversation with Edgar Martins, who has the exhibition here, This Is Not a House. Edgar's works were first commissioned by the New York Times magazine and records the housing crash in America. As you can see, we've made a selection from his series of works of both interiors and exteriors and the landscape around housing developments that were abandoned in the US. Edgar spent about a month, a bit more than a month in the US across about six states, specifically targeting these developments to go and photograph them, but without prior permission, but never a problem, and happening upon these fascinating landscapes and interiors. So I'm going to let Edgar do most of the talking. Do feel free to ask questions during or after the talk. Normally about half an hour or so, can be longer. It's entirely up to you. Okay.
Great, thanks, Anna. Okay, thanks so much. thanks for being here today, firstly. If I could just ask, it'll be quite hard for me to keep putting my gaze around the room. Would you just sort of be able to congregate sort of in the center here? This will be great deal easier to engage you all at the same time, I think. Okay, that's perfect. Thank you so much. Well, let me just tell you a little bit about myself. I mean, I'm Portuguese by birth. The reason why I'm doing this is just to give you a small notice, because the lack of roots has very much influenced, I suppose, where I work and my way of working. So I'm Portuguese by birth, but I've never really lived in Portugal. My folks moved to China just after the revolution in Portugal, which was in 74. So I grew up in China most of my life. I lived there for 18 years. I started out studying philosophy and literature, and I thought that that was really going to be the route that I would go down. And then I had the opportunity to publish a small book of what I now sort of consider to be a very naive interpretation of things, but it was my first attempt at trying to communicate with the world. So that was at the tender age of 18. And what really happened was that book was very helpful in terms of making me realize that I wanted to study visual imagery. So I put all of that on hold for a little while. And as I was living very close to Hong Kong, I decided to actually do some research. And that's where I really came across some very good photographic courses here in England. So I started out by doing a BTEC in Reading for the first year, followed by a BA in photography and fine art at London College of Printing in London, and that was finished with an MA again at the Royal College. Actually, the BA was at London College of Printing, the MA at the Royal College, that's right. Okay, so today I'm just going to talk you through some of the work that you have, that you see here. But before that, I just really want to contextualize my practice on the whole. So if you didn't really know my work, you could say that at a glance it deals essentially with two themes. The first one would be the impact of modernism on the environment and on our consciousness, so on our social consciousness, if you like, and also with photography as a process. I mean, I'd like to think that my work communicates ideas about how difficult it is to communicate. So the process of communication is an actual is intrinsically related to how I approached certain subject matters. However, I mean, I've always hoped the work went much further than this. So in earlier projects, I was really interested in theater, in performance, but not in the traditional sense of the word. I mean, this performative element is actually still very much relevant in this work, though at a slightly smaller level, and certainly on those three images that you see on there. But we'll get to those in a little while. I was interested in performance, but I was interested in recording the world's performance as itself, but as a set of processes and facts. And the only way for me to achieve this, I found at the time, was to slow down time. So that's why to this date I work with long exposures, mainly with long exposures. And that's also why I work with my photographic camera like a video camera. So photography for me is neither a shutter-based art of time nor a lens-based art of space. If I can just make a small play of words here, I prefer to describe it as a time-based art of space. Okay, so just to finalize, I mean, in those earlier projects, I didn't really see the landscapes and objects depicted in those images as that landscapes or objects, but as events. So my images often offer us encounters with a time suspended before or after an event. You know, they represent a memory of an event that may not actually have taken place. And I think you could say that they portray sort of a wider temporal reality, which you can't really pin down, so you can't really identify nor deny. And this sort of atemporal quality of the work is fairly important, and that's very much represented here in this work. So you could say that my work highlights a sort of point of resistance, you know, a resistance to the world of flux and flow that we live in, to a world haunted by mobility, if you like. But a mobility that isn't really defined as speed, but as intangibility and uncertainty. Okay, in terms of this work, I mean, I know Hannah has already briefly introduced it, but let me give you sort of a background story. In the winter of 2008, I was commissioned by the New York Times magazine to produce a project about the collapse of the U.S. housing market and the worldwide economic downturn. So I traveled around the U.S. for a period of 6 to 8 weeks and photographed 16 locations across six separate states. I started out going to Montana, sort of north central America, and then followed the East Coast all the way down, went to Phoenix, Arizona, Atlanta, Georgia, went up the West Coast, and finished in Connecticut, New England. So the project really focuses on a wide spectrum of different types of developments, which can range from your normal residential development right through to some of the biggest developments, hotel developments in Vegas. Okay, when the project was finally published in the summer of 2009, it became the focus of, and I'll use the word debate here loosely, it became the focus of a sort of a heated debate due to my decision to digitally reshape a select few images. So I think the first thing I'd like to address, because it's integral to the work, is why did I decide to tackle the project this way? Okay, so I mean, I worked with quite a few authors and philosophers on the book of this work, and one of them, called Peter Osborne, pointed something out which I think was quite interesting, which was that I approached this project as a sort of photographic intervention into a crisis, and a crisis that was only in part economic. And by this, I'm referring to the wider crisis that journalism, particularly photojournalism, is going through with the advent of digital technology. And the other interesting thing is that I've always been very conscious of the way that, of the role that ruins have played throughout, the representation of ruins have played throughout U.S. history, and how this subject matter is normally represented. I mean, America is a settler nation, and often an unsettled one. So the house, the shelter, have special connotations there. And any disaster that involves the shelter or the settlement, if you like, immediately extends into a metaphor for a whole historical process. So I was very conscious of the way that images of disasters, of the role that they have played throughout U.S. history. I mean, let's think about sort of the Brooklyn riots, for example, or perhaps the FSA images of the Great Depression. And perhaps more recently, over the 9/11 images. All of this type of imagery about these very big disasters have really served to sort of furnish and perpetuate sort of that big epic that are the United States of America, which are an epic of disasters endured and overcome, but an epic nonetheless. Okay, so that's generally the background. So I viewed this this project from the outset as a platform to really rethink and reconceptualize a particularly a contemporary landscape and phenomenon. So you could say that the project tries to reunite and catalyze fresh experiences of a new form of American architecture, if you like, by summoning what I normally like to call a disquieting conjunction of fiction and realism. And fiction is quite important, has always been important in my work. The author Jacques Rancière, he says that the real needs to be fictionalized in order to be thought. So the real doesn't just need to be fictionalized, it needs to be transformed and translated in order to be understood. And I think one of the things that this project tries to establish is that over time we have accepted the fictions we have created as facts, almost making us the forgotten authors of our own narratives. So the houses depicted in this series don't really just refer to the particular. They're not just images of individual people's homes. They are almost like spatial assemblages, kinds of stages, of which a number of quite different, and I guess maybe even incompatible narratives might be enacted. Look, photography for me is a medium, has always been a medium built around conceptual tensions, you know, so it offers me a means to bring together irresolvable contradictions. And I was really trying to bring together some of those contradictions in this work. So So these houses, these buildings, these ruins, whatever it is that you may wish to call them, they really reflect back at us the constructs or the human constructs and ideas that we project on them. Okay, so what I would like to do now, if that's okay, is just walk through the space with yourselves and just talk to you a little bit about some of the images and perhaps some personal anecdotes about the project on the whole. And as I said, if you have any questions or any specific observations that you'd like to make, feel free to interrupt me anytime. Okay, well, let's just move this way. This photograph was produced in Atlanta, in Georgia. This was a whole suburban neighborhood. I mean, it was the process of producing images is quite. Sorry, Hannah. I don't really want to block you away. The process of producing images is normally quite an introspective process for me. Quite intense, sometimes very analytical, but also very introspective. And even though you are always emotionally engaged with the subject matter, because otherwise you wouldn't be there in the first place, it's very difficult to always get emotive in the act of photographing. And this was one of the very first, this and another project I produced about forest fires, where I got this sort of, I was a little bit overwhelmed by emotion in the spaces themselves. I mean, the images that you see, this interior, it was shot, if you take a look at the back there, you'll see three small images. That's a small cul-de-sac inside a very large suburban neighborhood in Atlanta. And I mean, it's a neighborhood of maybe around 30, 40 houses, each one of them completely abandoned and left behind. The interesting thing about this development was that it was maybe about 95% finished. But because either the developers or the bank didn't really have either the money or perhaps the interest or will to really pursue it, they really just left it completely unopened, unattended, unguarded. So inevitably what happened was that people went into these houses. I mean, these are high-spec homes, I would probably say, for upmarket, I mean, they are upmarket homes. They would have been maybe four or five bedroom sort of houses with three, four very big lounges, possibly two, three garages. So this just sort of gives you an idea of the size of the homes. What happened in a lot of these developments was that people inevitably went in, started stealing what they could to furnish their own homes. And obviously, as always, what happens in these situations is they also started getting vandalized by, I presume, just bored kids. Most of this project is actually completely factual. I'll probably say that perhaps about 80 to 85% is completely factual. But there are three dominant characteristics in terms of my approach. One of them was a small element of intervention on the sites, but you'll quite clearly be able to distinguish those from the rest of the images, because those really stand out as almost like performative interventions. This is one of the case, and those three images that you see at the back are another case. Now, I mean, you could ask, well, to what extent do those performances go? Does that mean that I positioned the rock where it is? Does that mean that I moved the door where it is? Does that mean that I piled up all the rubble that you see in some of the images in order to for dramatic effect, if you like? Does that mean I placed every single leaf that you see on that image there where it is? And the truth of the matter is that's a very valid question. And it's certainly a very valid question if you know that there is an element of intervention from the artist. But it's an important question, because one of the things that I set out to do in the beginning was to really produce a body of work that engaged the audience, particularly a documentary audience, in a different way. I accepted this project for two reasons only. I have long expressed anxieties towards how a vast majority of photojournalism operate in. And I felt from the outset that this could have been a very good opportunity to produce a sort of, maybe not an alternative, but perhaps a different approach to how certain types of subject matter are tackled, particularly within the documentary context. And my main criticism of photojournalism has been twofold. The first one is that it's largely incapable of representing process. So let's take the example of war, for example. I mean, how often do we see an event polarized in terms of the aggressors and the victims? And how often do we really see a body of work that talks about the process of war? I mean, no doubt it's a much more challenging thing to do, and perhaps even incompatible with photojournalism's timings and timelines. So I wanted to produce a project that opened up different narratives and that talked about the process of actually thinking about images and of producing images. And that's why my intervention in these spaces was quite important. I mean, I know that the idea of objective truth doesn't really hold anymore in critical theory, but I don't do these interventions to assert artistic authorship. That's not the reason why. It's so that really the work can depict the subject matter it's trying to convey, but at the same time open up a whole host of different narratives, of a whole host of different possibilities to engage the viewer, again, in a variety of different ways. So what you see on here, the only element of intervention on my part is actually this small bird. And I'll tell you a small story about the bird. It's just a small curiosity, but I thought it was interesting. This is a real bird. It was real at one stage. It's not real anymore. This is actually a taxidermy bird that I found whilst traveling to many of the developments that I went to. I don't know if you've seen the exhibition prior to arriving here. Have you had an opportunity to have a look around? Okay, well, if you haven't, we'll go back there. But at the end of this wall there's an image of a sort of a suburban setting with some brick buildings. And we can look at it better at the end. And at the end of those brick buildings, you see the only part of the building that's lit. That would have been the showroom. Now, that showroom, just like all the other places I visited, were very poorly guarded. In fact, the showroom didn't even have a door. I mean, that showroom was furnished with the most incredible, amazing, expensive furnishings that you can imagine. Sort of the highest possible silk linen, Bose sound systems, bottles of Cristal. All aspirational, obviously. And on the top floor, on the fourth floor, they had a small veranda with four taxidermy birds perched on it. So I decided to borrow one of the birds, if you like, for the course of the trip, thinking that perhaps they might come in handy at some point, but always knowing that I would leave them in the space, in one of the spaces, to make them give them poetic justice, if you like. And the only reason, the problem with this sort of subject matter is because it's very real, and this project was produced in 2008. It's as real as you can get, and it's still real today. It's still relevant today. It's still prevalent today. The problem with depicting this kind of subject matter is that it's very difficult to not make evident its brutality, the sort of all the drama that's inherent to it, and. I wanted that to be evident in the images, but I also needed to soften that a little bit. And I needed to soften that so that other ideas could come to the fore. And regardless of whether there is an element of intervention of mine in these images or not, I see them as stages in some ways. A stage where the person who's looking at the images will sort of perform, enact some sort of narrative that's true or that's personal to him. Hopefully also taking into account some of the things that I'm trying to convey. As you can see, all of the images are placed fairly low, and they all sort of replicate the perspective that the viewer would have on site. Obviously, as you move around the room, that changes somewhat. But if you were to stand more or less here and look at the images, that's the perspective I'm trying to recreate. So I'm trying I'm trying to really step away from the idea that the viewer is looking at an image in the wall and perhaps at a porthole to the space itself. And obviously some images are more effective than others at doing this, particularly the slightly larger images like the image of that corridor. I want to really create the sense that the person's actually entering the room. Even if it's just for a fraction of a time, a fraction of a second. Obviously, the other thing that you see here in this exhibition is the variety of sizes that I've deployed. People always seem to ask me, well, why different sizes, and why is it relevant and important? And the truth of the matter is, it may not necessarily always be important. In the case of this work, it was, because there are so many things at play here. There are so many different ideas. There are so many, complex narratives. That what I wanted to create was sort of a, I wanted to the viewer to have sort of a distancing, and then to actually enter the image, and then sort of to distance himself from it, and then enter the images. And the two different types of sizes permit this. So with these slightly bigger images, I mean, I know that people are always curious to go up to them and look closer, but you can only really see them, especially at this height, well, if you really distance yourself from the image. Whereas with these slightly smaller images, you'll tend to go up close and you'll inspect. So this is all about engaging the viewer in the public, in sort of reading the work or relating to the work in perhaps a more active manner. Okay, now the other thing I would like to say is that, I work in a very specific fashion. I mean, I work with what we call a sort of a large format camera, which is I work actually with two different types of camera, which is a 4x5-inch plate film camera, and also an 8x10-inch plate film camera. People always ask me, well, why not digital? And the truth is, I wish I could work with digital. It would make my life so much easier. Not only would it make my life so much easier, but it would make the whole process so much cheaper. So there is no doubt that I wish I'd made life easier for me. But the truth of the matter is, I work with plate film because I guess I like to be surprised every time I produce a photograph. And there is an element of all of this that's still quite experimental. Perhaps not so much with the day images, but certainly with the images that you see that have been photographed at night or at dusk and so on. Photography, I view photography almost as a type of visual archaeology. So I like to go and discover spaces. I like to go and sort of discover the process. And I like to be surprised every time. So it keeps things fresh. and whereas some of these day images perhaps are more straightforward to produce, if we can just move down this way, I will... we'll probably be going up and down if you don't mind. Straightforward to produce. Some of these images produced at night or at dusk are a great deal more complicated. For those of you that know my work, you'll know that my practice has been structured around actually approaching subject matter in a specific type of light and also at a specific time of the day, which inevitably tends to be at night. And this has got to do with what I mentioned earlier about sort of the notion of slowing down time. When you slow down time, your relationship to the space you're photographing also changes, and your relationship to the medium also changes. Let me just make a quick side tour on this notion of sort of slowing down time. I started questioning photography's relationship with the real, its indexicality, if you like, very early on, in projects such as Black Holes and Other Inconsistencies. And I did this by immersing myself in a vast array of literature which ranged from physics to pataphysics. This is again just a small curiosity. And in terms visually, the way I tried to sort of tackle some of these ideas was by perhaps working on exploring, if you like, romantic appropriations of principles such as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And for those of you that don't know the principle, I won't bore you with too many details, but Heisenberg basically says that you have the ability to change the essence of things just by mere observation. Obviously, these were based on studies done at a sub-molecular level, and they don't apply to the real world as we know it. However, I've always liked the idea that any given space can change for you and you only, the viewer, the photographer, and every time it's observed. And if you slow down time for long enough, you may just be able to capture this. And I interpret this change as a sort of performance of space. So This is not particularly relevant in this work here, but it will contextualize my approach in terms of sort of the darker images. So basically what I'm trying to say is that, there is sort of an inherent performance in anything, even if it is a non-space, even if it is a non-event. What is necessary is for you to give the time for that to happen. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, I've worked a lot with long exposures, and even if you're in a banal field in the middle of nowhere with very little lighting, and if you produce an exposure for about 3 hours or so, the most incredible things happen. I mean, the way and the light sort of affect the film, sort of create the most stupendous results and create things that you could possibly even call events. I mean, how do we know they're not events? Maybe they are events. So I think this is a point of resistance to the things that have always defined photography, which were the decisive moment, the decisive act. And photography for me is not necessarily about decisive moments or decisive acts. It's about rethinking or reconceptualizing, I guess, the spaces you're in and your relationship to the medium. Okay, so in the case of this image here, this image was set up at dusk. It was set up at dusk, and there was a hill behind me, and that's why this is pretty much quite dark. And what you see on here is actually the reflection of the sunset going, the sun setting behind me. Now, as you can see, this is a panoramic image, contrary to all of the others that were here. I have worked with panoramic images in the past, and in fact, I've gone to the extent of creating a panoramic back for my camera, having a custom-made panoramic back for my camera, and having a custom-made dark slide made for my camera, so that I could actually use panoramic film and even expose half of the film at a time. So this was a specialist thing that I did, and I will never do this again, because it was a complete nightmare to work with. And there's no film. For those of you that buy large film, you'll know that there is this film, you can't buy it anywhere. It took me 6 months to try and convince a high-profile film supplier to produce 50 sheets of film for me. And I think they only really gave in the end because they were sick and tired of hearing from me. Anyway, the point here was that I had to, as you can see, this is quite claustrophobic compared to the rest. And I see this image, contrary to the others, I see this almost as a portrait of sorts, whereas the others I see them as more as sort of a performative landscape. So I see this almost as a portrait, and that's why there is a great deal of space in the images, and this is far more claustrophobic. Now, what I wanted straight away was, I realized that this image looked very, very odd, and I realized further that it would look even stranger and even more ambiguous if I could photograph this at night. The problem was I was in a neighborhood with absolutely no artificial lighting, so I knew that I could only shoot in the day, and if I were to photograph at night, I would have to at least set up in the day and then perhaps go around with my manual flash, which is a small Metz flash that I have. So the two things that happened with this image. The first one was, because I didn't have a panoramic camera with me and I had a specific type of lens, if I really wanted to just represent this, I would have to go very far away from the image, very far away from the house, which would have meant I would have had quite a lot of space around the house. So what I decided to do was I took two photographs of the house, one of this side of the house and one of that side of the house. And then those two photographs were put together at a later stage. And the other thing that happened was I set up at dusk, as I said earlier, and then I went around the house with a handheld flash, and I just tried to flash the house as many times as I could. I mean, I'm actually in this image, so in some ways it's a self-portrait offset, except you can't really see me because I'm running around from one place to the other, always having my body between the lens and the camera so that you couldn't see the source of the flash itself. Obviously, even if you had seen it, I mean, I would have had no qualms in terms of sort of retouching it out, but what I wouldn't want it to have done is to have had sort of flashes in these areas here, which would have meant more intricate work. I didn't really want to do this. I wanted to keep the work as spontaneous and as organic as possible. Now, the reason why it looks like the house is floating on here is actually because there would have been two pillars here at some point or another, two pillars on this side and two pillars on that side, and a front porch on here. And you can see that someone quite painstakingly went in there and sort of unscrewed the whole thing down and obviously made a front porch, perhaps in some other house. I would have loved to have seen where that front porch would have ended up, because the likelihood is it would have been in a house very different from this one. Okay, so again, that's a small curiosity. Now, I would like to just quickly take you around the room and just show you the different types of developments that there are in this space, tell you a little bit about each image. And again, if I remember any sort of other anecdotes that you might find interesting, sure.
How long was the expiration for that?
Goodness, I'm not quite sure. I think it probably would have been between 30 minutes and 40 minutes, I'd say, yeah. I mean, to be honest, that's actually not a very long exposure. Sometimes in interiors, I can actually use exposures of 30 minutes in interiors as well. Yes, reciprocity failure. Sure. Well, that's a good point, actually. Let's talk about that for a little while. You know, photography has always been defined for control. You know, it's either the control that the photographer has over the subject matter he's portraying. It's either the control that the photographer has over his subject, or the control that the medium allows you to actually have on any given circumstance because of how far technology has come. I've really created a visual language of relinquishing some of this control. So the things that interest me are not really photography's possibilities or the possibilities that it opens up, but its insufficiencies or in its inadequacies. And what I mean by this is, for example, most photographers would run away from this idea of reciprocity failure. I mean, for those of you that don't know, reciprocity failure is when you daylight film is set at its optimum for a certain type of exposure, and the longest exposure that it's usually that you usually see in graphs that's been tested and where they can guarantee the sort of the best performance is probably up to around 2 minutes. From 2 minutes it's onwards, the film manufacturers can't really guarantee what will happen with the actual film, how the color layers will be affected, and so on. And what I've realized is that the latitude of film is a lot bigger than people might think it is. And one of the things I actively seek out is the effects of this sort of corruption of the process, not only on the film, but also on the photographs themselves. So whilst that's not particularly evident in these images, and an exposure of an hour and a half is usually my normal exposure. And I produced a whole new project that's on show at the moment at the Wapping Project Bankside, but you won't get to see because it will finish today, the exhibition. And that was wholly produced inside power stations, hydroelectric power stations. And with that project, I was working with an 8x10 camera, which means your exposures have to be even longer if you want to have as much depth of field as possible. So the exposures can run to about 2 hours if you want. Just to photograph an interior that with a 4x5 camera would probably have been about 25 minutes, 30 minutes. And I didn't really notice any effects on that. But when I'm photographing in the dark, and I'm referring to specifically a project called When Light Casts No Shadow. If you're interested, I mean, I produced a whole project in a set of airports on a couple of islands in the Azores. In the Azores archipelago off the coast of Portugal. They're in the middle of the Atlantic, and these airports were quite interesting because they were one of the very few black-tarred airports in the world. So I produced images with very, very little lighting, with exposures which ranged from an hour and a half right through to 4 hours. And the effects of those exposures are absolutely incredible. And that's why I was referring to earlier that that's why you could possibly almost argue that something happens in this time. I mean, photography is defined by the single frame. This overlapping of frames that happens in those 4 hours creates a sort of atmosphere, a kind of environment that the human eye would never be able to capture, not even the moving camera. And I'd like to call those things events rather than just recordings. Okay, so to answer your question, in this specific case, there isn't really a great deal of reciprocity failure. It's impossible to time this sort of things or to measure the light for these sort of exposures. If we're using a normal handheld camera, you'd probably get a sign saying the computer says no or something of the sort, you know. The truth of the matter is not even a handheld light meter will actually give you the correct exposure to do. So there is an element of experimentation that's inherent to all of the work, even some of these images, and sometimes even to some of the interiors.
Just a slightly related question.
Sure.
Do you use E6 or C41?
I only use film. Only use so C41 process.
Okay.
Yeah. The reason for that is because slide film has got a much less latitude. So whereas, I mean, I know some of you won't be technical minded, and I don't want to transform this into sort of a technical talk. But if you want to understand the process, perhaps I should just mention this very, very briefly. The slide film is perhaps a little bit presents a lot more constraints in terms of how you expose the film. So if you have very different types of exposures, which range from, you know, very bright lights to very dark shadows, it's very difficult to get an in-between balance. Whereas with negative film, that happens a great deal more. And that's why I only use mainly negative film. I wish I didn't, because it's so expensive that it's an absolute nightmare. And I mean, if any of you have used large format 8x10 cameras, you'll know that even today it's almost practically impossible to order the film over the counter. I mean, to buy the film over the counter, you'll have to order it more often than not. Okay, so let's just move this way and let me tell you a little bit about the different developments. So this is the perfect example of, again, another domestic development, even though it could perhaps look like an office block or even a movie set. You know, the reason why I was immediately drawn to this space was because I had been trying to photograph movie sets for about 2 years prior to accepting to produce this project. And as soon as I got to this site, I realized that this was exactly what I had been looking for, something that looked realistic yet had sort of fictional properties to it, something finished and also slightly unfinished. You know, I was completely astounded that throughout the sort of month and a half that I traveled around the US, I never came across one living soul inside these places. I had expected to perhaps see people vandalizing the spaces, perhaps seeing squatters, if you like, perhaps seeing even workers, but I didn't come across one single person in these developments. And that was great at the same time, but also very eerie. It's sort of creating a very unnerving experience. With this image here, I'm on the second floor of an adjacent building, exactly like this one. And again, I set up my camera around 6 o'clock in the evening when I knew that light, sort of the sun would be setting, but I would still have enough light here. So this would have been about a 45-50 minute exposure. And what happened in that time, the street lamps came on. That's why you can see some of this light. So the street lamps would have come on for about the last 5 minutes of the exposure. I mean, this was completely accidental. I wasn't aware of this at the time. As are a lot of things in a lot of my work. As I said earlier, I can't presume to say that I can control everything. So I purposefully look for a lot of those fortuitous sort of acts, if you like. Obviously, there is an element of control nowadays because I've perfected exposure techniques. And what you see on here is actually the movement of the sky during that time. Again, I mean, if I were to say to you that I knew exactly how this would come out prior to photographing, I would be lying to you. I don't, and I don't want to know. I hope I never fully know how images are going to come out, because otherwise I think I'll probably give up shooting. So this is a very specific development, again, residential development. The New York Times asked me before I engaged in this project, they sent me a whole host of images of different types of developments, and they said to me, look, which ones do you think would be more interesting to photograph? And, you know, the developments they sent me ranged from, you know, sort of big office blocks in Miami right through to all sorts of commercial developments from hotels and so on. And whilst I did photograph one specific hotel in Vegas, I told them that I really wanted to focus on the domestic environments, because I felt that those would be the ones that would resonate the most with the viewers. And I think that's possibly why people have engaged with the work so much, is because you can almost imagine yourself living in these houses, or at least going into these houses. So that was quite important, was to create that proximity with the viewer. And in fact, that proximity is translated in many different ways. As you can see, I mentioned earlier about the height of the images. I mean, they're sort of hung a little bit lower than most photographers I know hang their images. And also, there is no glass whatsoever on these images. I mean, I've never liked glass anyway, because it does create some sort of barrier. But let's make no mistake, again, it's it makes your life, it makes things a lot more difficult to have images without glass. But it also makes them a lot more tactile and it makes them a lot more inviting. And that's the reason why I don't exhibit images behind glass. What you see on top of this image is a seal. A seal that took me about 4.5 years to research with the lab that I work with. most labs do seals. Seals aren't very archival. By this I mean they tend to sort of, after a while they shrink, you know, they leave glue residue. So they don't really protect the images in the long run. This seal is actually archival and it was so it's important from the States. And what I realized with this seal was that not only did it eliminate reflections, which glass creates, obviously you have museum glass that sort of eliminates reflections, but it still creates a barrier. I mean, every time I go into an exhibition and I see paintings that I've been wanting to see for years behind glass, I feel cheated. And this happens more often than not nowadays, at every exhibition that you go to. So I try and break away those barriers. And as I said, the seal also creates the texture of the photographic paper, of the matte photographic paper, which is something that I was after. Okay, let me go on to these smaller images here. I see these images, that image there is actually the introductory image to the book. And that's that development that I was telling you in Atlanta, Georgia. All of these three images were actually photographed in the same place. These two images there, this one and that one, believe it or not, are not the same house, but are three actual very similar houses next to each other. The interesting thing about this image, for example, was that, again, I started photographing this at dusk is when the sun sets, right? Okay, sunset. No, the sunrise, okay. That's so silly. I started photographing this at sunrise. We set up, I went there about 5 o'clock in the morning, the sun would have the sun would have rose around 6 o'clock in the morning. So what I did with this image was I asked my assistant, I don't normally work with assistants, but in this particular case I needed fixers to get to the spaces as quickly as possible. So I asked the assistants to really flash the house with the car headlights as much as he could. So he did that for about 25 minutes or so, and then he switched the car headlights off, and then I went around the house with a flash, trying to, again, flash whatever I could. So once again, I'm in this image, but I go around like a ghost, if you like. And obviously, as I said, it's very difficult to control this, and if I'm perfectly honest, possibly usually between 30 to 40%, sometimes even a higher percentage of work ends up being discarded, because the process is so experimentational. Now, if you look closely on here, there's a stop sign that says Wisteria Way. And I thought this was quite interesting because it made a direct reference to that very popular, it's not really a soap, it's a sitcom, isn't it? That sort of a Desperate Housewives. And this really, I mean, you know, this is a way to really just sort of reflect on popular culture, really. But, I mean, these are the typical suburban American neighborhoods. The almost iconic type of house, American house, that we would imagine from overseas, particularly if you've never been to the States. But obviously, even if you were there, even whilst there, you'd recognize this as being sort of the traditional American home. And as I said, I mean, I was absolutely astounded by this space. Now, what you see on there are actually people's belongings. I didn't really quite fully get the story behind why they were there. But it was my understanding that the development had gone bankrupt. So most of the houses were almost completely built, but the majority weren't. They were practically finished, but I mean, there were actually different levels of finishing within there. But as my understanding was that one of the houses had actually been sold, and the gentleman there wasn't able to actually pay his mortgage. So he got evicted from the house, and he got evicted, and people went in there and then just vandalized the house and threw all of his belongings on the street. So the drama is still present in these images, and it would have to be present because this story is all about human drama. Except what I was trying very conscious to do, not to do, was to personalize the work too much, and to, I guess, transform this slowly, solely into a story of human tragedy, because there's other more important things also at play here. You know, you have to be also conscious of all the social and political factors that went into these things. And I'm hoping that this sort of transpires a little bit also through the work. Okay, we can move on to this side here. From the rest, and I submitted them to the New York Times too. And you can quite clearly see that there is an element, some sort of performative element or some sort of intervention element in these images. And as I was saying earlier, where there is an element of intervention on my part, it's perfectly visible. So you couldn't possibly take these images as anything other than, they couldn't possibly be documentary images or photojournalistic images. So I was quite conscious to make that fairly and that's very clear also with the image of the bird on top of the rock. I mean, you can quite clearly see when you see the bird closely that that's a taxidermy bird, not a real bird. And the chances, anyway, of finding a bird like that, which is from a completely different environment than the interior of a house perching on top of a rock.
But you nearly believe it is a real bird.
Yeah, you nearly believe it. But actually, you know, this the I don't like to call it deception, but there is an element of suspended disbelief is always important. You need to always suspend disbelief while looking at an image. But I've always liked to believe that the highest point that you can achieve when you're reading an image is when that that moment of suspending disbelief sort of comes crumbling down, and you realize that the perception you had initially made of an image, you know, with all your sort of perception mechanisms. Actually, there's something more. Perhaps there's something else going on. So you have to somehow engage the viewer by making them believe in the space you're depicting or in the event you're depicting. But then you need to try and convey to them somehow that there's sort of a layering of truths and a layering of narratives, if you like. And it's true. I mean, if you don't look at the image carefully, or perhaps even, I'll be honest with you. I don't mind even if people always believe that that's a real bird. The point of the matter is that once you come to images like this, you realize that actually not all of this is shot as found. So that's hopefully where you need to start questioning, why this sort of performative element? And that's the most important thing, is that the viewer questions the process. Coming back to what I mentioned earlier about sort of that inability for a certain genres within photography to really sort of represent this notion of process. Okay. Now, in terms of these images, what I did is, I call them either small performances or sculptures, whatever you like, they sort of fit within both categories. And what I did was I tried to create these very sort of silly, playful, ridiculous sculptures using the debris found on site. So whatever I found in those rooms, that's what I used in those specific rooms. This would have been a postcard on the other side. That would have been a postcard on the other side. And this here was this is quite a silly exercise, let's be honest. Trying to create sort of put a stick on top of a block of sponge and making it not touch the wall. And the only reason why it actually did that in the end was because it had a nail sticking at the bottom of the the wooden stick, and that actually somehow clipped onto the ground to a small hole that was on the ground. So that was completely accidental. But it took me about 40 minutes to produce some of these sculptures. I mean, that's quite ridiculous, to trying to produce something for 40 minutes, trying to put them sort of precariously in an unstable position. What I really wanted these playful images to do was to talk about the fragility of the spaces that they were photographed in. So that's their role in the work. And it's also, they also help to convey this sort of fictional element within the work. So that's also their role. And whereas all the other images aren't individually titled, these ones have got individual titles. So this one would have been called, is called Untouchable. This one's called Meeting of Minds. And this small one here is called failure to launch. So there's no real resonance, there's no real clinch between the title and the images. There's really just a resonance, a reverberation, which you can't really define, identify, or deny. And in this image here, I didn't really spray paint the line that you see on the back. This was already there. All I did was sort of nudge the tile a little bit to the right. But as I said, I mean, I'm very conscious. Normally, I don't actually intervene in the spaces I'm photographing. This was the first case in which that was done. Most of the projects I had produced up until then and since, pretty much I just photograph a found scenario. In this case, it was quite important for me to sort of break that mold and also participate, if you like. I mean, this is one of my favorite images from the series. There's not really much to say about it. It's, again, photographed in Atlanta, in Georgia. This house and many of the others that you see of white interiors were photographed in this specific place. And I think it was one of my favorite images because you can see that, I mean, you can quite clearly see that this was ready to move in. I mean, if it weren't for the hole in the ground and all the insulation on the floor, I mean, this was ready to move in. And in fact, I mean, there is no other place in the world where you'd have this sort of surplus of housing and no one actually making use of them. So what really transpires through this is the excess that happened between all before all of this bankruptcy and sort of ruin took place. So there is this constant reference to these two polarities of sort of excess and an aspiration and then sort of ruin and bankruptcy. This image here was photographed in Connecticut, in New England. This was a $10 million mansion, which, I mean, you could literally just walk in. The doors were open, so you could walk in. Surprisingly, this house was actually fairly well kept. And what I had been told in the New York Times, I actually initially thought that the New York Times job sheet already had this information, but I later looked through them and they didn't actually contain the information. So what I think happened was I remember the fixer that went to actually view the house telling me in one of the meetings that I might come across something like this, sort of leaves on the floor. And I think what happened was that they did have people that went in there every so often sort of cleaning up the rooms, but instead of just throwing the leaves out, they used to pile them up in a little mound and leave them somewhere. Then obviously all it would have taken was someone to walk in. So this is entirely as found, certainly in terms of the leaves on the ground. The rest of the other elements of intuition were quite small. Now, I want to talk to you about these two images here, because, and actually these three images, so let me just move on to this side. That image there was taken in Bakersfield in California. Now, I don't know if any of you know Bakersfield. Does anyone here know Bakersfield? You do know Bakersfield.
I landed the first shuttle, I think.
Right, absolutely. Well, for those of you that don't know it, you don't need to know it. It's the ugliest, the saddest city in the world. It's the saddest town in the world, unfortunately. It's known for its oil drilling and for its sort of a very harsh terrain. And that's probably partly why they had the idea of constructing one of the biggest golf courses in the States there. Now, this isn't actually the image of the golf course, but if you're interested and if you'd like to have a look at the book, you'll see images from that golf course and you'll see the difference. I mean, this is still a little bit green because this was photographed in Northern America, but in the area where these images were taken, the golf course had already completely dried up. I mean, it was absolutely incredible for me to go into this place and see all of this golf lawn. So you know that they use special type of lawn in golf courses. All of it had sort of completely dried up with rabbit droppings everywhere. I mean, those images are in the book, so you can quite clearly see them. I will say that I don't know if you mentioned this, Hannah, but I didn't have permission to photograph any of these spaces. So all I was equipped with was a letter from the New York Times lawyers saying that if if he gets arrested, don't hold him for too long. Well, it didn't really say that, but it was more or less along those lines. In other words, if I were to get arrested, I'll get arrested anyway, except then what would have happened is that they would have just probably got in touch with him. I mean, someone asked me yesterday whether I ever got worried or had any trepidation about visiting these places. And I never do, because the adventure element is always quite important. But in the back of my mind, and I only thought about this once prior to actually arriving in the US, I thought that, well, if I get arrested, I'll be blacklisted, and then I'll never be granted a visa again to the States. So that was the only time in which I thought about what might happen. But aside from that, it was just absolute excitement, like sort of a kid in a sweet shop in a way. So the reason why I mentioned about that image was because I photographed a whole set of row of houses and, again, various different developments, such as the one you see on there, but also such as images like this one here. And again, if you see the book, you will come across, in all of this sort of desolation and emptiness, you will come across a photograph of one person, one person only. Now, I started photographing empty spaces. It started out as an idea that I had on the second year of my BA at the London College of Printing. I thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be interesting to photograph spaces devoid of their social function? In other words, spaces that we understand as being very social spaces, but completely devoid of people. So I produced a project where I went around very public places and tried to photograph them without people. It's very hard. I mean, impossible to control that. And the idea was always never to Photoshop people out. So, and to some degree, to maintain true to the actual motivation. And that really stuck with me throughout. And for two reasons. I found that, and I guess that this may perhaps be debatable, but I truly believe that empty spaces allow the viewer, the public, to really project their own humanity a great deal more, particularly if there are, already sort of remnants of human activity and things that we relate with. The other thing is that these empty spaces end up working in the same way as the very black areas, the black skies in my images, which you'll come across if you see other bodies of work, which they end up almost becoming like sort of blank canvas on which the viewer, the public, can really project their own sort of experiences onto. However, when I produced a project called The Accident Theorist, I did this project on a set of beaches on the Portuguese coastline. And it's a project just about sort of empty, deserted beaches, and it was photographed only using long exposures and refracted lighting from nearby sources of lighting, such as stadiums or highway lights and so on. And what I realized in photographing those beaches for a period of 2 years is that all sorts of things happened in that time. You know, in the summer, they used to have tractors going through the beaches and cleaning them and sort of flattening the sand. In the winter, they got very dirty, and sort of spring, they started building cafes. And then in the next summer, I started noticing events taking place on the beaches, end of year, school parties, fashion shows, and so on. And I photographed, it wasn't accidental, I almost boycotted this image. I saw an image of a girl with some balloons from the back. And I thought to myself, well, this is almost too beautiful, too interesting a moment to sort of fit in the series, because all the series is about this sort of lack of moments, if you like, or portraying movement in still things. And everything screamed movement and decisiveness and click, 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 click about this image. So I boycotted it almost as much as possible, by thinking, well, should I not? And in the end, I actually did a 2 to 3 second exposure of that girl with the balloons. And when I processed the image, the balloons were still as you can find them, almost unnervingly still. If you wanted to reproduce that in a million years, it would have been impossible to get them that still. And I thought that fittingly, that really belonged in the work. So from then onwards, I've always thought to include one person in each body of work that I've produced. So you'll come across different different books where you see perhaps just one person in each book. And that, aside from each person having a poignant story to tell, which is obviously curiosity because it never really gets translated, never really gets divulged to the viewer unless you're speaking to them in situations like this one, These persons depicted in the images all almost act as vessels. They become vessels for the photographer, they become vessels for the viewer, and they also provide sort of a sense of scale, perspective, and so on. One of the things that I often get told a lot is that these look like, my images look like small models. So the sense of scale and perspective sort of completely dissolves in the work. And that's okay for the most part. So, but having that one image was quite important. And so this is a very long preamble to just say that this house here, it was almost at the end of my trip. I came across one person sort of spray painting the ceiling. And I mean, it completely took me by surprise. I was taken back. I had visited so many different spaces. I had been on the road for so long. And there it was, just one single individual lonely person sort of spray painting the ceiling. And obviously, I mean, you know, I was curious to know why. I mean, he saw me coming in and he didn't even ask me anything. He was just going about his thing. And I mean, this was a development that hadn't gone completely bankrupt, was going nowhere quickly, and more likely than not would probably be torn down. I mean, this is just my assumption. I don't know, but I presume so. So I asked him, so what are you doing here? And this chap told me, well, you know, he was a Mexican chap, and he said to me, I've been paid to do 30 days of work, and I'm not going to leave until I finish my work. So I thought it was quite poignant. Here's in amongst all of this ruin and bankruptcy and sort of here's someone with all of these sort of upstanding values and morality. But again, this is a story that you won't necessarily know by looking at the images. And this in itself is interesting because it really highlights the paradox of images, which is they're never enough. You know, how much can an image actually tell you? Never enough. You know, in fact, I always find photography a highly inadequate medium for communicating ideas, you know. But actually, it's this anxiety with the medium that really spurs me on to find a new language with which to work with and sort of to communicate, if you like. So, when I look at an image, I never really say, I don't just ask, what does it tell me? I always ask, what does it not tell me? What is it? What else is it omitting? What else is it hiding? And what I hoped that this project would do was bring up these same questions in that specific context, which was sort of an editorial and documentary context, where people are used to actually reading images in a very specific way. And there's no doubt that, I guess, you could say that the veracity of the lens, or the way in which we still nowadays associate photography with realism or truth, has been largely responsible for creating a voyeuristic culture that really treats and views images gratuitously. So, without sounding presumption, this whole project, all the works that I've done to date, are not only about sort of engaging the viewer, but also re-educating the eye, even my own eye, in terms of how I read images and look at images and question images. And I think without really extending myself too much, or without demystifying the images too much, this is probably as much as I can tell you, but I'm quite happy to take any questions if you do have any.
Yeah, I'd like to really just follow on from what you were saying there. Sorry, it's not a technical question this time.
No, but if you have,
So a lot of these images, I'm reminded that architectural photographers are both praised and criticised for idealising their subjects. What I actually like about what you've done here, I mean, I looked particularly at this one, this is what struck me when I was looking on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You created almost what would be the architect's perspective drawing.
Absolutely.
But for non-film, you've absolutely idealised this view. But I like the juxtaposition,
the
contrast, the fact that
right.
And also this is something that happens obviously in wealthy areas because they can afford those sorts of production values in their building as much as you do with your photographs.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the subject matter is about the collapse of all of that, this is very much the drama at play, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a reminder, I think that's sort of follows through from what you were saying.
Sure, it's true. I mean, one of my it was very important to me to reinforce the image, the image of architecture, in all sort of the architectural model, if you like, in a lot of these images. And I'm happy
see that the images are photographed in a very specific way, which is almost like rectilinear straight planes. I put my camera at height level always, and that's always how I photograph. I don't really photograph from any sort of angles or... I have in the past, but what I mean is since I've developed a specific way of working, I don't do that. And this is as much... This is more methodology than aesthetics. I'm not shooting in this way because, you know, I'm obsessed with rectilinear lines or because I think they're beautiful, but because photographing in this way reinforces the illusion of photographic transparency. And that's quite important in the work, is to sort of reinforce that illusion of photographic transparency and to almost make the spaces hyper-real.
Yeah, I said just thinking of the work you did on power stations, I was looking at those and I was actually reminded very much of, you know, Renaissance perspectives.
Right.
Because, again, this is a process of idealization, but you know there's something going on. I mean, particularly because it's a power station rather than, say, a palace or a cathedral.
It's true, but in some ways they act, they function the same way in terms of the architecture of those spaces. This is a new project the gentleman's referring to that I've just finished. The book's going to be out now. I produced, I'll just tell you very briefly about this. I was invited by a large cultural institution a couple of years back to produce a project about, well, they actually didn't give me a brief. They told me, we'd like you to do an artistic intervention in some of EDP, that's Portugal's main electricity company, some of their power stations. So there was no brief or theme to start with. It was up to me to really produce, to produce a concrete proposal. I decided early on that I really needed to make the focus of the work the power stations themselves rather than the dams. And it was for three specific reasons. First of all, I didn't really want to represent water. The second one was that, you know, I felt that I had nothing to contribute to a culture already saturated by photographs of dams, you know, which have really been worn out by decades of heroic images about the subject matter. And the third one was that the power stations are by far the images that are less well known. And now, referring to what you were saying, if one compares the architecture of some of these older power stations to perhaps more modern ones, and I mean, I'm talking about a period which ranges from the 1920s to the 1970s, it becomes immediately transparent that these weren't just mere economic or functional projects. They were also aspirational and social projects. So you can see that there was sort of a heroic political will that went into building them. You know, everything about the architecture screams, I want to be divulged to the world. But the interesting thing about those particular power stations is that, you know, when they were built, they aimed to be exponents of what we today associate with the ideology of the modern. And the interesting thing is, obviously, we now know nowadays that nothing really panned out in the way that the ideological narrative of the modern really made us believe that it would. So there's a really interesting sort of a confluence of temporalities at play in the work, as there is with most of my other work. And in fact, just another small side note, the reason why you don't see a lot of people in my work, and the ones that you do see are almost, I mean, they end up being sort of a very ambiguous in terms of their dress, so that I can also cut out temporal references from the work to make the work as atemporal as possible.
Two questions.
Sure.
What was the original commission? Was it one minor or was it a discussion? And two, did you find the chair?
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention about that. That's a good point. do you mean the original, what was the original
New York
brief?
The Times Commission, was it a very simple brief, or was it something that you discussed with them?
Well,
together?
Sure. Well, the theme was the collapse of U.S. housing market. We discussed the locations, but we didn't really discuss the approach. What we did discuss beforehand, that it was about finding the right project for me to work on. Look, we can call it a sort of a misunderstanding or sort of a clash of minds, if you like. I mean, the debate is very easily contextualized, actually. And the debate itself was sort of centered around several false premises. But I think the truth is that there was a misunderstanding in terms of the rights and values associated to the creative process, you know, which on one hand made a very sort of a prestigious organization who have always really sort of promoted, I guess, this interaction between documentary and art photography. Perhaps you might might say somewhat precariously, you know. But on one hand, you know, there was sort of a misunderstanding in that regard, that that an institution like them could have really commissioned a project such as this one without fully communicating, you know, their journalistic parameters and limits. And on the other hand, there was, I guess, someone with a background specific as mine working on a subject matter also in a very specific way, where the work for me was never just about the subject matter, but it was also about producing a project that reflected on the documentary model, if you like, on the documentary framework. But what I don't disagree and deny is that in order for situations like this to be avoided, there needs to be dialogue. And if in hindsight, perhaps there were certain expectations made of the work, and maybe less dialogue than there might have, that there should have been, I think.
And the chair?
The chair. yes, I was getting to that. Actually, the chair is quite important because that was photographed as found. And it was inspired on that, that I actually produced those. It was inspired on things like that that I found. And the interesting thing about that is that as soon as you walk in, you look at that and you think, well, how do you take this? How do you interpret this? If it's a trap, it's the most rudimentary, silliest trap that you can think of. If it's not a trap, then you look at it and you think, well, then it's, there must have been a lot of very bored people. And actually, you got a real sense that that happened towards the last few weeks that people were at these sites. Because when I visit a lot of these sites, you could see that someone went in there, perhaps the bailiffs, perhaps the bank, perhaps the police, one day and said, everyone out. So there were a lot of shoes, people's shoes still lying around all in a row, half-drunk cups of tea, you know, people's hats, clothing. In fact, I mean, that spray on that wall, I mean, I don't know what the effect would have been, but I saw small things like this of perhaps people in sort of their downtime playing around with small things. You know, it was on the basis of that that I produced those images, because I saw them as being very theatrical, you know, and if not anything else, then they told me a little bit of a story about what went on in those spaces. The silliest thing about that place, though, is that you could easily have walked in from the door behind that, so you could have walked in without actually disturbing that chair. And I actually photographed, as soon as I walked in and set up the camera, the slightest bit of movement, actually, the whole thing fell apart. So that in itself is also quite interesting, because you wonder, well, you know, I mean, how long haven't people been here for, you know? Probably a long time. Anyway.
This gentleman here?
Yes.
Oh, no,
okay.
Once you're on the location, especially with some of the interiors, how do you choose your frames? How do you decide what's important and what's not important enough to present?
I mean, it's quite hard. It's quite hard. It's always the most difficult thing. Normally, what I do is, again, one of the reasons. I'll answer just in a second, but I just want to just make a quick detour and just mention this. Again, one of the criticisms I've always had of the sort of the traditional photojournalists, and look, I'm just generalizing here, because there is good documentary photography out there, as there is good photojournalism. I'm just talking about this in very generic terms. In some ways, the idea of the intrepid photographer that goes into places and photographs everything, just about everything. My way of working is fairly introspective. This is partly for logistical reasons, you know, the size of the camera, the weight of the camera, the size of the plates, but also it's sort of a methodology, you know. So normally what I do is I would have walked into a site like this, would have put the camera down, and then would have gone around for about 4 or 5 hours just looking everywhere without the camera and making sort of a mental register of the things that I wanted to photograph. I mean, there are photographers out there that are extremely good at sort of documenting everything, every single facet of what you're doing. I can't work like that. I'm filled with anxiety if I know that I have to walk into a space and I have to document every single facet. So you have to make choices. You have to make choices very early on. But in order to make choices, I have to familiarize myself with the space beforehand. Because if I feel like I'm not acquainted with the space, then I also feel like I have no reason for being there, and that there will probably be better people out there, better equipped than I, to really deal with the subject matter or with the space itself. in a context like this is very different though, because whereas with I normally with my projects they tend to be very sort of a long running, so they have gestation periods of 2 to 3 years. With places like that, you can go over and over to whatever it is that you're photographing. I almost said power stations here, but this is because in the case of the power stations, I mean, they're placed in very remote areas in Portugal. So not only do I have to travel to Portugal, but also travel within Portugal for 5 or 6 hours. And I revisited each power station 3 times. So I'll revisit the spaces over and over and over. And that's important because I want to engage with the space that I'm photographing. In this case, I had 2 days at most with each space. And what happened was I found myself after this first or second space I photographed operating in the exact same way that I had always criticized, you know. So that's where I realized that I had to really rethink this project and just engage with it in a different manner. And that's where all of these different elements sort of fictionalizing, sort of intervening with the space sort of came in. And that's when I actually stole the bird. well, borrow the bird, if you like.
Any further questions at all?
Did the New York Times do anything? What, did they do a colour magazine?
They published the work in the magazine to start with, and then they did a slideshow online. What I will say is that actually the reason why the debate actually ignited in terms of the work was because the project was defined in a very specific way, which was with long exposures but no digital manipulation. Unfortunately, I hadn't previewed the layout nor the texts. And I think this is actually what ignited the debate, not the work itself. I mean, I was always very aware that the work would cause some discussion. But what I didn't really envisage was that the route the discussion would go down, partly because of that slight contradiction in terms of how the work was presented and how the work was actually conceived. So the slideshow online was actually eventually pulled out from online. But actually, look, this is a blessing in disguise. To be honest, at first I couldn't really, I was on holiday, the first holiday I had taken in sort of 5 years when this whole sort of thing ignited. So I couldn't really believe what the fuss was all about. I didn't really understand until I realized that how the work had been sort of described and so on. But actually the interesting thing is it really ignited a debate that, I mean, this is an old debate, let's make no mistake. It's a debate that to some degree still surprises me that's still going on. But actually it ignited different facets of the debate. And also it extended the shelf life of the project by, by years that probably it wouldn't have had. I mean, every project has got its sort of own natural shelf life, maybe 2-3 years. I mean, this project was produced in 2008. We've done sort of about a 19 seminar talk program so far. And this is the opening tour you can show here in the UK, which we'll be traveling on to until 2013. And again, there's other touring shows around the world. So in some ways, I've become sort of a reluctant speaker for a lot of these issues that sort of deal with the journalistic ethics and parameters and so on. But I'm quite happy to take on this role in some ways because there are other interesting things at play in the work. And as a matter of fact, my main concern when I started working on this project was, is this actually going to be given enough time for people to be able to just view this beyond its immediate subject matter? And the truth is it has now, you know. And hopefully there is enough information out there for people to be able to make up their own minds about the work and about, sort of all the ideas behind it.
So we've been going for over an hour now, so I think probably we should thank Edgar, and then we'll just be here for a few minutes if anybody would like to ask an additional question. So thank you very much, Edgar.